When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Must be a slow news day as the kookery has bubbled to the top. Evidently, they raided P. Diddy's house. Now, evidently, P. Diddy is the new Jeffrey Epstein. And rumor is, P. Diddy's got Obama on tape. It doesn't get any kookier than listening to someone drone on for a half an hour about how raiding a rapper's abode where he's got cameras all over the place is, you know, the CIA honeypotting, you know, congressmen. Yeah. But my favorite is, the fact that, you know, Joe Biden is breaking the sex traffic rings, that Donald Trump failed. Wouldn't it be ironic? And again, I'm just throwing this out here because it is kookery day. Wouldn't it be ironic if in the P. Diddy tapes, there was Donald Trump? Remember, they were buddies, right? They were hanging out for a while. P. Diddy had the thing and all that. Weren't they buddies? Wasn't that part of their thing? I know he was in big with Kanye, but I thought Diddy was there too. We'll see. We'll find out. I'm sure inquiring minds want to know. And look, they're already predicting that P. Diddy will meet his demise. Also, the kookery, as I predicted, you would see a lot of, this was a planned attack on the bridge in Baltimore if it weren't George Bush and the 9/11 squad coming back, it would be Joe Biden doing some wet work. Or this was a terror attack. This is a cyber planned attack. And evidently, these people have inside information. And what I love about what the right wing has done, and they do this masterfully, they're good at it, man. They make these weird, just bizarre stuff kind of statements. You know, it's a terrorist attack and, you know, they're going to come and do this, this and this. And, you know, we're at war. And when it happens and they go, see, we told you bad things happen. Or it doesn't happen. They go, well, because of us, we averted all that attack. So it's, you know, heads they win, tails they win. It doesn't matter. And I keep asking myself, when do we wake up and say, you know, I'm tired of this? When do we turn off the crazy right wing kookery? When do we stay, you know, look, not everything's a conspiracy. Not everything that every accident that happens is Al-Qaeda or Joe Biden. I mean, obviously, you know, it's either if it weren't the Clintons, it would be Obama, Michelle, or it would be Joe Biden doing some wet work. But interestingly enough, you know, someone sent me this. This data analysis done by this guy named Howard Polskin at The Writing. And he talks about the fact that a lot of the right-wing websites have seen their traffic tank in the last month compared to the last presidential election. They pointed out that Twitchy dropped 93%. The Federalist dropped 91%. The right-wing rag of the Washington Times, 80%. The Western Journal, 84%. And a lot of, you know, again, the Drudge Report over 80%. Breitbart down almost 80%. People are tuning out. And CNN, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, they saw drops, but nowhere near what these right-wing outlets, what's been going on. And I've been saying for a very long time, I think a lot of that's manufactured. I think a lot of it is, funded by people, in rich positions to do a lot of pushing. For instance, this week we found out that, one of the royal family, a member of the royal family in Qatar, put $50 million into Newsmax, because I had always wondered, how is it they're on the air? But now we know. And this is the thing about a lot of right-wing media. There's questionable money. It's, as someone who has seen a lot of this stuff up close and personal, I've asked, how is it possible that they're this well-funded? And the reality is there's big money behind their message. And their message isn't about democracy. Their message isn't about better society. Their message isn't about making people's lives better. It's about hate, anger, and division. It's about separating us. And this is one of those moments where you go, at some point, don't we have to, stop? And maybe it's happening. Maybe people are finally tuning out of this kind of right-wing kookery. Or the bigger fear, people are tuning out. I had talked about years ago when Scott Walker was being recalled in Wisconsin. What the right learned then is, if you just throw enough stuff at people, if you just berate them enough with, all kinds of political messaging, call them at, 6 o'clock when they're sitting down at dinner every single night, that people will just repel the message, that they'll just want the pain to stop. And there's part of me that goes, I think the right is starting to get some of that political fatigue, as where before they were heavy junkies. Gotta have my right wing this or that. What's the latest conspiracy? I think they've kind of jumped the shark in some of this stuff, to where even when you're looking at, you saw the container ship hit the bridge. I'm struggling with it's a terrorist attack. Now, we're going to find out exactly what went wrong, and I'm going to argue port maintenance. I'm going to argue that this is another company that cuts corners. There's a bunch of reasons for this, and it comes down to regulating and overseeing and all of that stuff. But the right takes this, it's terror. So I'm hoping it's not people are dropping out. I'm hoping people are being a little more judicious in the messages that they get. Because it's amazing to me that I talk to people who I believe are intelligent, rational, reasonable, and some of the things that come out of their mouth that they state as fact is just, what's been thrown out by these right-wing websites. It's the kind of narrative that they've been pushing on people for a very long time. And I guess it's, you keep reading it, you keep seeing it, you internalize it, you believe it. I'm hoping we're starting to think a little bit differently. But evidently, P. Diddy is the new Jeffrey Epstein, and Joe Biden evidently blew up the bridge. And look, I understand that bridge, major economic thoroughfare. This is going to hurt the economy. Oil prices are going to go up. Bad things are going to happen. But the idea that it's a terrorist attack. Okay. I want to hear your thoughts. You buying that? You buying any of that? Do you think the conspiracy has merit? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I got a lot to get to. Bibles. When we come back, we're talking Bibles. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm sure everyone has seen the new Trump grift. He is selling a Bible. And I guess this time he did hold it right side up. He didn't have it upside down. But in this Bible, this is a very special Trumpian kind of Bible because it's got the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And just in time for Easter. So the perfect time to be, you know, pushing your poison. And it got me thinking, you know, there was another president who came out with a Bible. You may remember the Jefferson Bible, where he went and he rewrote the whole thing and took out all the miracles and just focused on the philosophy of being a decent person, of, you know, helping your neighbor, that kind of stuff. Also, Jefferson, the guy who is credited with coining the idea of there being a separation, a wall, if you will, of separation between church and state. Seems like a good idea. Also, you had another president, James Madison, who thought, you know, should we give money, public taxpayer money to churches? Should we incorporate church and state together? He didn't think so. So he vetoed a piece of legislation titled An Act Incorporating the Protestant Episcopal Church in the Town of Alexandria in the District of Columbia. And his rationale was, you'll poison the church. Again, separate. Wall of separation. But not now. Not now. We've got the Trumpian MAGA hat wearing world saying, no, we want them both. No wall. And here to share some thoughts on, is this a good idea? Is this right? I've asked Rachel Lazar to come talk with us. Rachel is the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Rachel, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So, you know, I'm looking at this and there's some history of presidents with the Bible. The difference is that they didn't marry the Constitution and the Bible together in the past. This is kind of new.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, it's not surprising given what we saw in policies that came out of the Trump administration, but I think it should sound the code red alarm bell about the threat to this foundational part of our democracy today, which is church-state separation. It's severely under attack. And this hawking of this Christian nationalist Bible is a masterclass in what Christian nationalism is all about, actually.
But shouldn't, I mean, if you are a Christian, shouldn't this scare you a little bit? That this...
Yes. Sorry.
No, I mean, Shouldn't... Let me leave it there. Shouldn't this scare you? I mean, if you're truly a Christian, shouldn't this scare you?
I mean, it should scare you a lot. I mean, one of the reasons it should scare you is it's never good for religion when the government merges with religion, right? That's really what Christian nationalism is about. It's a political ideology and a cultural framework that seeks to merge Christianity and America, you know, and patriotism, right? The true Americans are Christian. You know, what Trump said in this recording, hawking this Christian nationalist Bible is that, you know, we're a Judeo-Christian nation. That's part of this myth, right? We're really a Christian country. He signaled that what we're missing is Christianity, right, today, basically signaling that the way we can be the best America is being a Christian America, right? And honestly, I actually, Rick, I got to tell you, I'm Jewish, right? I find it offensive that he talks about Judeo-Christianity as the root for this country, because you just cited the founding fathers there, You know, and you know, Thomas Jefferson, right, who really was so proud of this concept of church-state separation that it was part of his grave epitaph, you know, he talked about back in the late 1700s, Rick, he talked about the Jew and the what he called the Mohammedan and the infidel of every faith and the Christian. Like, he talked about all of us, and that's what America is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about protecting everybody's religious freedom. America wouldn't even be America. We wouldn't resemble ourselves without church-state separation.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a long line. I mean, George Washington, you know, was in on this. You know, John Adams, you know, the letter to the, it was Washington with the letter to the Treaty of Tripoli, that, you know, the Muslim have no, you know, nothing to fear with us because we're not a Christian nation. He was very clear in that, because to me, the First Amendment is about freedom of, and I would argue, from religion. I practice what you want. You do your thing. Let me do mine. And let's not infringe on each other.
Right. I mean, it protects both religion and taxpayers' religious freedom. Right. I mean, that's what Thomas Jefferson said, that it's sinful and tyrannical to expect a person to support a religion that's not their own. Right. So it's about taxpayers' freedom. It's about preserving the integrity of faith. And the First Amendment's really interesting because it includes both the Free Exercise Clause and the Non-Establishment Clause, right? And they work together. So you can practice your religion freely. That's great. That's America. But when you practicing your religion freely starts interfering with me practicing my religion freely, we've got a problem, because America is about freedom and equality, right? And that's how those two clauses work so well together. The government can't favor my religion over yours. The government can't favor my religion over someone who doesn't have a religion. That's how we protect true religious freedom.
You know, and I saw Trump, you know, hawking his new product, the Bible. It made me think of Gandhi, who's famously said, you know, Jesus I like, Christians not so much. You know, that to me is one of those perfect things. I like your Jesus, your Christians not so much.
Well, you know, Rick, I mean, this is the thing. We were founded at Americans United for Separation of Church and State by a group of Christians. We were founded 77 years ago by a group of Christians. And even today, some of our most strong supporters are not just Christians, but Christian clergy, right? They're the plaintiffs in our lawsuits. They're on our National Faith Advisory Council. So I just want to really say that a lot of Christians, you know, coming back to your point, are so offended by this effort to merge the Christian identity in with the American one. They see it as degrading Christianity, and they should.
Now, what's interesting to me, Rachel, is I reached out to some of my hyper Christian folk, the people who wear it all over their sleeves, and I asked them their thought. And I said, hey, and I know they wear the red hat. I know they're big Trump supporters, nationalists, if you will. I didn't find anyone offended. I found people who thought, hey, he's a businessman. You know, he sees an opportunity, and that was really disheartening to me, because I would expect my religion folks to go, no, that's sacrosanct. You don't tread on my religion. Or am I missing something, do you think?
You're not missing anything, Rick. And again, I'm just going back to the point that Christian nationalism is a political ideology. It's not a religion, right? It's a political ideology and a cultural framework that says America was founded to be a European Christian nation, and our laws and policies should reflect that privilege going forward and should codify it. So anyone who tries to claim that Christian nationalism is true Christianity will actually run into a lot of problems with a lot of Christian clergy in this country.
Yeah, but what's interesting to me is, and I try not to you know, talk about people's intelligence, but I've had these weird moments where, and, you know, this last day has been one of them, where, you know, asking people about this merging of the Constitution and the Bible together, there seems to be a lot of misconceptions about both documents, and, you know, what's in what, what's in the other. It seems like societally we've already merged a lot of it through, well, misunderstanding and misinformation. For instance, I had someone tell me that, you know, the Bill of Rights is based on the Ten Commandments. And I go, yeah, okay, they maybe both started off with 10. I guess that's a beginning. But it seems, and I don't want to mock this person because I really like them, but it seems that there's so much wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Bill of Rights, obviously the first 10 amendments to the Constitution is about protecting individual rights, right? And so obviously it's not based on the 10 commandments. I mean, look, we live in a world where there's like a zeitgeist that has religion in it. We live in a country that has religion in it, right? And that always has, and that's fine. No one's criticizing that. That's great. We actually celebrate religious freedom here, right? So, but the point is, we are governed when our government is making laws and rules, that we are governed by our American values and not one religion's values over any other. It all gets to be sort of translated through our American values. That's about the only thing that binds us as a country, because we were set up to be a pluralistic country. We were set up to be diverse, right? That's the glue. It's our American values. And without them, this country wouldn't even resemble itself.
No, I'm with you on this. So but walk me through this, because, again, I haven't found an awful lot of my Republican red hat wearing friends who are, I haven't found any who are upset by this. I'm quite disturbed by the fact that there is this want to merge the two. Walk me through what you think, if this were to happen, if we were to tear down that wall of separation between church and state. Do you agree with Madison that it would corrupt the church? Do you think it would make, you know, government better, worse? I'm curious. Do you have thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for asking that question, because I think church-state separation is so cerebral that a lot of people just can't really conceptualize what is it really about. But we're already beginning to see what it looks like, Rick. I mean, no church-state separation means you don't get to make your own decisions about your own body according to your own religious beliefs. So you don't have reproductive freedom, for example. You know, when you don't have church-state separation, LGBTQ people aren't secure in our society. And we saw with the death of Next Benedict, the non-binary kid in Oklahoma, after the governor and the superintendent for public education were not just spewing anti-LGBTQ rhetoric, but were also passing policies and forwarding and implementing policies there. They're religious extremists, and LGBTQ people aren't safe. You know what else goes, Rick? Your right to read and learn, right? We're seeing all this book banning happening across the country. What about the limitation of what kids can learn in school in the curricula that are being revised to kind of weed out anything that might offend someone who thinks European Christians should be superior? So teaching about the country's history of racism. What about teaching about accurate science, right? And not having evolution replaced with creationism. Right now we've got a bill in West Virginia that passed both houses that would allow arguably for the teaching of creationism in public schools. You know what else, right? Public schools get vulnerable because there's an effort from Christian nationalists to divert all public funds from public schools to private religious schools that also can discriminate and that don't have to abide by our government standards for schools. So I'm just skimming the surface. What about the rights of religious minorities and the non-religious? What happens to, they're no longer equal. We have clients who are Jewish in Tennessee. They can't foster to adopt a kid because their local taxpayer-funded foster care agency won't work with them because they're Jewish. We have a Catholic client in Simpsonville, South Carolina. Guess why she wasn't allowed to volunteer with kids in need at her local foster care agency that she funds with her tax dollars? Because she's Catholic and not evangelical Protestant.
Wow.
You know, I could go on and on, but so many rights sit on that wall, and so many freedoms sit on that wall of separation.
No, I've been told I'm hyperbolic when I say that I can foresee a future where we have a Christian version of Sharia law here. And you've laid out a lot of what I've talked about, the fact that and look, as a straight white male, landowning male, you know, could be a good world for me to live in. You as I've said, you know, they want women back in the kitchen, gays in the closet, and minorities in the field. The difference is I got daughters. I don't want them to live in that kind of world. I got a son. I don't want him to live in that world. So how do we stop this? I mean, you know, how do you mobilize around the idea that we're looking at kind of a dangerous future?
We really are. And I'm so glad you asked that question. it's time for a national recommitment to church-state separation. We need more education on it. We need more commitment to it. We need people to elevate it in their priorities, because they're not. And the thing about this issue is it's a uniter. I mean, think about Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. One of the many reasons for church-state separation is they were afraid about the violence and divisions that happen when there's one religion that's favored over others, right? I mean, you can just look around the world. It's really a dangerous situation. And frankly, as church-state separation has been more and more undermined in this country, we've seen more and more violence. And a PRRI poll shows that Christian nationalists are, in fact, much more likely to be violent than non-Christian nationalist adherents. So I think what we need to do is recommit to church-state separation and join hands across communities. The faith community should care deeply. I know they don't all, Rick. I know you were saying that, but there are a lot who do.
No, look, at the end of this, Rachel, you know, I've always believed religion is about making us better people. It's about making us a better part of a community. It's about taking care of the least among us. It's about peace and social justice. It's about what makes us better. What I'm looking at, and this is what really is the frightening part, is where we're heading is this is allowing us to be the worst versions of ourselves and only saying that, well, it's divine intervention that's making me do this. That's what's frustrating and angering to me. I want people to be religious. I want them to, you know, love thy neighbor and feed the hungry and care for the sick and, you know, all down the list. But that's not who we are.
Right. No, I mean, I think that that's such an important point. And honestly, the polls are bearing out, not the, you know, the public opinion research are bearing out that about a third of Americans today are unaffiliated with religion now. They've left any affiliate. And you got to ask yourself, is this one of the reasons why? Because when religion starts to get associated with hate, right, and with violence, like January 6th and all the Jesus Save flags and appeal to heaven flags that, by the way, the Speaker of our House of Representatives flies outside of his congressional office, the appeal to heaven flag that was all over, that's associated with the new apostolic reformation movement, you know, the seven mountains, Christians need to dominate over the seven mountains of society or demons will, spiritual warfare, right? The Speaker of the House, the People's House, flies that appeal to heaven flag outside of his congressional office, okay? But I mean, I agree with you that when we're living in a time when there's so much negativity that's being associated with religion, it's debasing and degrading religion and taking people away from, frankly, also communities that religion provides. So if you care about religion, you too really need to care about church-state separation.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it's a scary time we're in, but you know, like they say, may you live in interesting times. These are most certainly interesting times. But Rachel, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your expertise with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Rachel Lazar, she is the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. I want to hear your thoughts. Does this concern you? I got to tell you, you know, seeing Trump hold that Bible, hocking it off the way, I don't know. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, the UAW, since the strike, since that historic contract, outdoing the hard work of organizing, they're organizing members at Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The people at Hyundai in Montgomery, Alabama. You've got Toyota workers in Troy, Missouri. And you've got Mercedes workers in Alabama who have come together and said, hey, look, we want better wages, hours, conditions, better treatment. We want respect, dignity, all those things that, well, we union members kind of take for granted. And what's happened is over 10,000 workers have signed cards saying, yeah, we want some of that. But with that comes, well, the union buster playbook, doesn't it? The harassment, the intimidation, potentially firings, all of the things that they've been getting away with for a very long time. And you got workers who've had enough. And the just recently, the Mercedes workers, the largest U.S. plant for Mercedes, they've filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board in response to, well, that company's harassment, intimidation, illegal union busting. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on, maybe why this is happening, I've asked Taylor Snipes to come talk with us. Taylor's a logistics worker there at Mercedes. Taylor, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
So let's start with the organizing campaign. What made you guys come around and say, hey, look, we want to sign these cards. We want to organize with the UAW. What brought this on?
Look, I think it's been, I think it's been tried before, and it's been coming for a long time. Obviously, with the way the economy is, the way the just the home life balance seems to go more and more negative every year, and just the way things have been shifting at Mercedes constantly, where it doesn't seem like a shift towards obviously the worker. It seems like a shift towards management and upper whoever's in the uppers that are going to just take more money out of, or put more money in their pocket out of this. So it just seems like push more and more every day to make life harder on the worker and easier on those guys upstairs. And yeah. I think people have had enough of it. And yes,
what I find interesting is the fact that Mercedes is a global company, and the only non-union plants are here in the U.S. The rest of the world, Mercedes workers have representation. They're unionized everywhere else. But here, and I think a lot of that has to do with how our laws are structured and the aggressive stance that this company and a lot of other companies have taken to keep workers, well, at their will.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is a big reason. Not just that. I mean, we're in the South. We're in a lower income area of the South. And I think they take that for granted, or they take advantage of that, and they push harder and harder to, keep it that way. They want to keep people down, less wages, keep the wages as low as possible, and they know that, so they're going to fight against it with everything they can.
Yeah, so you're going to see that division, you're going to see that fissure played upon quite frequently here. And now you guys have filed some unfair labor practices with the National Labor Relations Board. Sure. Walk me through some of this stuff. I mean, I was reading through some of the charges and some of the claims. It just seems like, union busting 101, start cracking down on little things that nobody ever talked about before, start harassing and intimidating people. Walk me through what your experience is.
Yes, sir. So I know my experiences. I'm not sure about the other guys too much or the other people involved. But mine personally, it seems since first when we said we were going to organize, you could feel it creeping like omniscient. And then when we went public with coming in with a union, it pretty much took a nosedive, and the videos started coming out of anti-union this, the union can't do this for you, they can, we can do this for you, and it just kept being pushed. And at a point it just becomes almost politicized at work, and it becomes it feels like it's an attack on the worker every day. For me personally, I just got fed up with it. I am pro union. I've been to the meetings. I signed my cards. Of course I wear union hat. I wear my bat, my pin, and I want to support the union. And I just asked, in a meeting, do I have to watch these videos? Are they mandatory? I didn't say anything other than that. I didn't push that I was against Mercedes. And, at that point I was told I needed to be in these meetings. They weren't mandatory meetings, or they weren't mandatory videos, but the meetings were mandatory, and I need to put my head down. If I don't want to listen to these videos, these anti-union videos, I just need to put my head down and try not to listen. after that, I could feel it all around me. I could see the eyes on me everywhere I went. And, later that day, I was grabbed for having my phone on equipment, which is a what they say is a zero tolerance policy, which is obviously not what what you see when you're working at Mercedes. It's not what is what's happening. You're told you're allowed to have your phones if you have permission from your higher ups, which I was personally told that. I have a son who's in daycare. Of course, I want to be able to contact the daycare or the daycare to contact me. And so at that point, they came and got me off the forklift and said, hey, you have your phone on you. And about, I'd say, it was, they asked me if I had my phone on me. Then about 5-10 minutes later, they want to come back and they said, okay, come on to the office with us. You know, I'm like, all right, here goes. I'm going to get a write-up. I'm going to get something. I've never had a write-up, never had, you know, never had a warning, never had a late, tardy, anything in my name. When they walked me to the office, they just kind of said, pack your things, you know. You're going to be going to the HR room now to see the manager that asked you about your phone and the HR rep. When I got in there, it was the same old spiel. You know, you're not supposed to have your phone. It's a zero tolerance policy. At which point I kind of brought up, you know, hey guys, it seems like this is retaliation. I said something in meeting this morning about not wanting to watch anti-union videos. At which point, they proceeded to say it wasn't about the union stuff. And in the next sentence, without even breathing, they said, well, why would you want to join the union? What does the union have to offer you? And started, you know, interrogating me about why I would want to join a union.
Well, I think this kinda, right here, what you're going through, I mean, right, yeah, here. Is,
exactly. And that's kind of how the conversation went. At that point I was walked out. My badge was taken from me.
Wait a second. Hold on. Stop. Whoa. I was expecting a write-up.
Yes, sir.
They discharged you for having your phone on you?
They did discharge me. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Immediately discharged after the meeting, walked out of Mercedes.
Wow. I was expecting a write-up. I was expecting, you know, some you know, surveillance, some stuff like that. But they walked you out over having your phone with you.
Yes, sir. With having my phone with me, which is known by my team leader, which is known by pretty much everybody around us. That's how we actually contact our team leaders. Like, say something happens, they're on the other side of the plant. Hey, man, I need you. It's also how I get in contact with my son's daycare. So I was in such shock in that meeting when they told me I was terminated that I couldn't speak. I mean, I just, it was disbelief.
Now I got to imagine that, you know, look, we know that in these union campaigns, employers, they're advised by these union busting law firms to fire people. They're advised to do what they did to you because it'll send a chilling effect across the rest of the workforce. I have found that when that happens, it angers the workforce. But what kind of response are you getting from your coworkers on this?
So I talked to a couple of coworkers. Some of them are saying, you know, good for me. Nobody's been negative about it. Obviously, it's kind of a sketchy situation. If you still work there, you don't want to say you're actively talking to somebody because they don't want the same thing to happen to them. I mean, everybody's got a family to feed. It's why we have the union, because we have families to feed, people to support. And I'm sure that nobody wants to bring that up, but the support's looking good from friends of mine, from my coworkers. I of course see on social media how it's, you know, the people who've been at upper management for 10 years saying stuff like, you know, they know they're not supposed to do this, or it's not about union or not, you know, but they don't know the details of it. So the people who are on the front line sitting there with us on forklifts, on tuggers, on whatever, they agree with it. The guys that are up there in the office, of course, they're saying, what a horrible thing to do. It's, you know, they got fired for good reason.
Now you said a moment ago that, you were forced to watch these videos, and the response they gave you is the union can't do this for you, but we can do all these things for you. And again, my question comes back to, if you can, why aren't you? Why haven't you been? Because, you know, what I find in my experience, workers generally organize not usually because of wages, not usually because of benefits. Usually it's about working conditions. Usually it's about treatment. Usually it's about, how people feel they're valued. So when I talk to people and I hear that line, well, the union can't do this, but we can do this for you. That question of, well, why haven't you? You've had all this time to treat us with the dignity and respect that we deserve and that we earn. Why don't you? And this is one of those moments where, you know, if I'm in your shoes, I'm fighting for that union just to make sure I get the dignity and respect I demand.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, they come out and they, every day is a new video about we can do this, or the union can't do this for you. But all you guys have done is taken from us. It seems like the only time you've actually kicked it in gear and tried to do anything is when you got scared and you started making videos and coming out with things because the union started coming along. And there's no promise that you're not going to snatch these things back away before. You've done it before. You snatched away bonuses before. You've done these things where you try to make it look like you're doing good and then take it away. So, you know, we can't trust that.
No, I'm right there with you. And you said something a moment ago that you said you're not against Mercedes. It doesn't have to be you're either with the union or you're with Mercedes. You can be a good Mercedes employee, but also be a member of the union so that you get what you're worth. You get what you earn. It doesn't have to be that kind of adversarial if or then. It can be both, I think. No?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I don't understand that. That's part of it that upsets me so much, is because if your workers are looking for a better life for themselves or looking for something to make them stronger, make them more together, why are you fighting so hard against them to try to make their lives better? I mean, it makes us feel worse about who we're working for. It makes us feel worse about going to work every day because now we're worried about it, or we feel like not represented, and we want to be able to have our own voice and have somebody looking out for us.
Yeah. Now, your situation, for instance, if you guys weren't actively going through an organizing campaign, if you weren't actively pursuing a union, I don't believe you would have any recourse other than maybe filing for unemployment when they fired you, because it's my understanding Alabama, like Pennsylvania, is an at-will employment state. They don't need a reason to fire you. But given the fact that you guys are organizing, you have a just cause kind of situation where that at-will that they're used to, that's not the way things go. So maybe give them the benefit of the doubt, they made a mistake. I'm not that generous, but I'm curious your thoughts.
What was the question? I apologize.
No, I mean, Alabama is an at-will employment state like Pennsylvania, I believe.
Oh,
right?
Yes, sir. Yes.
So the idea being...
Yes, correct. My apologies. Yes, sir. It is. That's correct. And it is an at-will state, and I wouldn't have any recourse. And there's nothing you can do. You go to the unemployment and say, maybe, hey, I got fired. And they're going to be like, what'd you do? And you go and say, hey, I was, you know, they fired me for a rule they had that they don't enforce, you're not going to get anything from this. I mean, so the only thing we have is this union. I mean, look at, I can't imagine how many other people are out there that have been fired for, you know, whatever reason in this community. And it's terrible. And with something that's, you based your economy in the area around this big plant, you came in and said you were doing these things for these people. And then you're willing to throw them out the door with nothing behind them, you know? And that's part of the reason. And, same with anything else. I mean, obviously a lot of people have heard about the FMLA things that have been happening with Mercedes. They've heard about, how there's no retirement at Mercedes. The medical is getting worse. They're making people pay more for their deductibles. And
It sounds like the perfect storm coming out of the pandemic, where you were told you were frontline heroes and essential, and I'm sure all of that stuff that you internalized, only to have them, well, treat you poorly. So I guess last question I've got for you, you know, do you have a sense of where this is going to go? Because ultimately, seeking a, you know, union job is seeking a better life. Thoughts?
Where is this? Sorry, I apologize. I had a cold here and that.
No.
My apologies.
The idea of, you know, where you see this going.
I see this. I see the union taking it, man. I think people are, with this happening and with, I think the previous lawsuit they had, like I said, with FMLA and them not allowing people, you know, sick leave. And I think more people in that plant, in my plant specifically, I know they've changed shifts on us three times this year. People are just tired. They're tired of this. And I think this union is going to come through 100%. I think we're finally going to get a voice. It's going to take some hard work. It's going to take some very hard work, but I think we're coming through this, man. And, the community is going to be better. There's going to be some naysayers. In the end, I think we'll all understand why we were fighting so hard for this.
Well, after all, it is all about the workers. It's not about the union. It's about the workers who are the union. And I wish you guys the best. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues Absolutely. Down the road. And I wish you the best personally as well.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Taylor, I appreciate your time. And no, look, this is... I didn't realize he had gotten fired. I mean, for something that's as minor as that, that is just a pure show of power. And it's what corporate America has been getting away with, which is why, again, we need massive, massive labor law reform. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are you as stunned as I am? I want to hear about it. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1977. That was the day that members of AFSCME Local 1644 began their unsuccessful strike in Atlanta, Georgia. The union was made up of 1,300 mostly black sanitation workers. The city of Atlanta had elected its first black mayor, Maynard Jackson, in 1973. According to historian Manning Marabell, members of the sanitation union had campaigned aggressively to help Jackson become mayor. Many thought he would be sympathetic to the needs of working people in the city. The sanitation workers' hopes were disappointed when they received no raises for three consecutive years. Their average income was $7,500 annually. This put the workers below the city's poverty line. Since the Memphis sanitation workers' strike of 1968, AFSCME had emphasized organizing black workers in southern cities. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated while he was in Memphis supporting the strikers. As the nation mourned the death of the civil rights leader, the Memphis strikers had won their first contract. But the sanitation workers in Atlanta would not win their work action. On April 2nd, Mayor Jackson fired the striking workers. He aligned himself with what Manning Marabell has described as Atlanta's corporations, media, and the leaders of the black party's bourgeoisie. Some black leaders publicly criticized the workers for striking against the city's first black mayor, accusing them of undermining hard-won black political power. The city's black middle class, by and large, did not support the strike. After a month, the strike was effectively over. Workers returned to their jobs with no improvements in their wages, hours, or conditions. And the hard-learned lesson that what politicians say at election time is not always what they do once they get elected. Like what you hear? Check out laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
One of the things I always say when talking about, you know, people joining unions is, you know, there are some things that are just universal. One of them is what we talked with Taylor about, the idea of at-will employment. And I want to get back to that in a minute. The other is having a contract. You know, just the fact that you have a contract in place that lays out your terms of employment, that lays out what happens in the event that there are problems, lays out wages, lays out benefits, lays it all out. So there's no ambiguity. There's no mystery. There's no, oh, well, we can cheat these people over here. We can pit them against them over there. No, it's all right there, black and white, very simple. Everything above boards. But having that contract, that's the important part. And I say all the time, there aren't any CEOs who don't have contracts. They've all got them. And oddly enough, they've all got contract with really good golden parachutes. In the event something bad happens, you know, like they screw up badly, there's a windfall for them on the end. There's a guarantee for them. There's a bailout for our CEO class. And I look at Boeing. Their CEO just found the exit, a guy named Dave Calhoun. Dave, over the last 3 years, made 63 million dollars. $63 million. And evidently, his going away prize. You know, if you screw up bad enough, they send you out the door with a going away prize of $24 million with the possibility that it could be $45.5 million. I got to tell you, and I've said this before, I've been fired before. Never, never, never has someone said, here's a boatload of cash. Thanks for screwing things up. And you know, this isn't new. It's not new. Happens all the time. You know, again, I go back to my favorite one being that Robert Nardelli, the guy who was the Home Depot CEO, screwed up royally. They fired him, got a $210 million handout, and then got a job as a CEO of another company that he then proceeded to help screw up. This failing upward, that doesn't happen for working people. Just for the CEO class. Why? Well, because they've all got contracts. And they all negotiate into those contracts really good things for themselves. And I keep saying that about workers. We need to have contracts as well. Contracts that say these are your conditions and this is how you can get fired. You know, I hear people say all the time, you know, you can never fire a union member. Yeah, you can. You just have to do it the right way. You have to go through a process. Just like you can't throw people in jail for no reason, you have due process. Same thing in the workplace. You have due process. In the work world, what Taylor got fired for, just having his phone on him. Think about this for a second. Every person who has a phone, every person who works, I know no one who leaves their phone in the locker like they're supposed to. Can you imagine coming in one day and the boss said, there's the door. You have your phone with you. You're fired. In an at-will employment state, absolutely. They can get away with it. And, you know, most of the states in this country are at-will states, meaning that the employer doesn't need a reason to fire you. And really, your only recourse is to file for unemployment, unless you can prove. And again, this is hard to do. Got to get a lawyer to try and prove it. You know, some kind of gender discrimination, some kind of race discrimination, some kind of age discrimination. You got to find something and be able to prove that the employer is doing this because you're old. And they rarely go, hey, get your racial, gendered, old behind out of here. You never hear them say that. They just say, thank you for your time. Here's the door. Good luck. Now, all those things they then say behind closed doors when you're not around and can hear them, but it's almost impossible to prove. So for me, the idea of having that contract really, really important. Because if they had a contract, that wouldn't have happened. It'd have been written up, you'd have filed a grievance on it, there would have been a hearing, they would have gone through a process. But in this scenario, in an at-will situation, which again, you know, almost every worker in this country, whether you think your boss is a good guy or not, you're an at-will employee. Now, I look at this Mercedes situation. You know, the reason that they moved these plants, Mercedes, Volkswagen, Hyundai, Nissan, all of them, Toyota, the reason they moved to the states that they moved to, all no rights at work states, because they know it's harder to organize workers in those states, because most workers have been, you know, since birth, told that unions are bad, especially in the South, just the word union is bad. They went there for that reason, because they knew that they could play on that divide. And what that means is they're going to be able to pay lower wages. They're going to be able to offer worse benefits. The working conditions will be inferior. And you can treat people however you want, because you're still the highest paying gig in the area. So you've got hungry, desperate people vying for what the better job in the area is and willing to tolerate a whole bunch of stuff. That's the reason they moved there. Now, what the UAW is finally doing, and I've been saying this for years, the unions have got to get out there and spend an enormous amount of resources to organize people. Because there is a want, there is a need for it right now. And the UAW is doing that. The fact that in this short period of time, from the end of the Big Three strike till now, they've gotten 10,000 non-union auto workers to sign cards. They're going to have elections at some point in the near future at places like Volkswagen, Mercedes. I mean, the other thing is, you know, understand, Mercedes, their only plants on this planet that aren't unionized are right here at home, right here in the U.S. And why do you think that is? How do you think that happens? It happens because our laws are badly broken. The fact that they were able to fire this guy without any real recourse yet is amazing to me. Which, again, is why I come back to, we working people have got to stand up for each other. We working people have got to say enough is enough. Remember that whole, you're essential, you're a hero. Remember that coming out of the pandemic? Frontline hero, essential. Thanks for showing up and making us profits today. Well, I think workers have internalized it. And now we're demanding it. So Mercedes, Volkswagen, all the rest of you, look out. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.